I was prepared to give quite a bit of a message on Daniel chapter 2, but I'm going to try to cut it short since you've requested that. And so what I'll do is I'll share my screen after a bit. We've already prayed, and I thank you for your prayer, Brother Patrick, and thank you for everybody coming. We know that the truth is very important for us at this time in Earth's history, and especially as we are nearing the coming of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. So truth is important to me. It's important to you. That's why we're here together. That's why we want to learn. And this truth is transformative. It changes our life. It gives us the ability to understand what it is that God has called us to do and be. And that's why in Daniel chapter 1, it made it very clear that idolatry is something that we are not supposed to be having. Idolatry is an experience that we are to get away from. And that is what God has made clear in chapter 1. That's the first angel's message. Turn away from anything that is in this world that would lead you away from God. In whatever you eat, whatever you drink, whatever you do, do everything for God. Nothing for the world, nothing for self. That is the practical application. If somebody wants more practicality than that, I don't really know what to give. But that's very, very clear. You, for yourself, in your own time, in your own study, can find how to eat and how to drink for the glory of God. Now, we could point out every single detail of that, but that would take a whole nother message. But what we're doing, though, is we're looking at Daniel chapter 1 and Daniel chapter 2. In Daniel chapter 2, what we've seen is the hour of God's judgment is come, or the hour of the king's judgment had come. During that time, God has given the spirit of prophecy, or the gift of prophecy, to Daniel, something applicable for us at the end of time. One of the applicable things for us to do at this time is to read for ourselves what God has given in the hour of judgment. And so, if we wanted something practical about that, that is where to go and how to get it. You unpack that for yourself. There's plenty to read, plenty to understand, especially right here. If we open up the Bible and we know this for ourselves, we are going into understanding what God has given us in the spirit of prophecy at the end of time. Now, of course, there are bigger and broader applications to that, but for those that don't fully understand, that is a great place to start, is the Bible. Now, in the time of Daniel, what did he do? He found people that he knew, whether it be Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and he fellowshipped together with those people. Now, the Bible makes it clear that we're to fellowship with those that are of like mind, especially as the day is approaching. You can see that in the book of Hebrews. We are to be fellowshipping with each other, and we are to get to know what it is that the mind of the Lord has revealed to one another. That's why we fellowship. That's why we come together. They were also in prayer. That's something we can do if we haven't been doing that very much. If we don't know much about prayer, study the Bible and find out what prayer is. And then, of course, what we can do is praise the Lord as well, thanking him for all the things that he's given us. That's what God has revealed in Daniel chapter 2 as a practical application for living in the time of judgment just before Christ comes. And so the diet also for Daniel chapter 1 was very important. That's why I talked about having been vegan, vegetarian for now 24 years. And Daniel was asking for the fruits, for the grains, the nuts, the beans, and the vegetables. Those things that Daniel asked for were what enabled him to have a clear mind for the challenges that came in chapter 2 and also further in chapter 3 and especially in chapter 6 as well. So we can see that when we're going through the three angels' messages in Daniel chapters 1 through 6, there are plenty of applications that we can make. Now, are we going to spend time this whole time pointing out those applications and making sure everybody knows exactly what they're to do? No, that's not my job. I will point out the principles, and you all can spend time focusing on what's going on here in the Bible and how it applies to you at your place, at your time, at this time in Earth's history. Now, of course, we all believe that we're going to come to the point where the Lord has led us all to a very similar experience before Christ comes, and that's oneness in faith, oneness in spirit, oneness in truth, and so I don't believe that that's going to be outside of our experience. We're going to be unified. But we all come at a different time and a different place. So I'm excited to share Daniel chapter 2. I'm going to share my screen here for a moment. And we're going to be able to see that in Daniel chapter 2, verse 29, it talks about, O king, the thoughts that came to your mind upon your bed, or when you were dreaming, what should come to pass hereafter? That's what God is showing to the king. It's a dream about things that will come hereafter. That means after this. And he that reveals secrets has made known unto you, O king, what shall come to pass. Future tense. It's not what did come to pass, what shall come to pass. And so in verse 30, we can see here, but as for me, This secret is not revealed to me for any wisdom that I have more than anybody living. But for the sakes of those that shall make known the interpretation to the king. So Daniel is saying here that really, if we understand these prophecies, it's not really because we're wise or understand anything about God more than anybody else could, but it's because God has revealed these things for the sakes of those that shall know and understand the interpretation for others, in this case to the king, and that thou mayest know the thoughts of thy heart. So knowing the thoughts of the mind of the king while he was dreaming, this is why God revealed the dream to Daniel. And so Daniel goes on and explains in verse 31, "You, O king, you saw a great image." And I'm imagining the king was now sitting on the edge of his throne. He was like, "That's right, that's exactly what I saw." "Well, this great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee." So it was standing. "And the form thereof was terrible." This word terrible, if you understand what the Aramaic word means, it means to make afraid. It's dreadful. It brings fear. It's terrible. It's very big, right? This was a very large image, very powerful. "This image's head was of fine gold." So the head was of a certain metal. It was fine gold. "His breast and arms," not just his breast, but his breast and arms, "were of a different metal." So you have the head was of one metal, and the breast and arms are of silver. "His belly and his thighs were of another metal," brass. So far we have gold, which is one metal. We have silver, which is another metal. And then we have brass, which is another metal. And then it says his legs were of iron, okay? "And his feet were a part of iron and part of clay." So we're gonna just go ahead and highlight that there. So what we're seeing is an image that's very different in five different ways, right? So you have gold, silver, brass, iron, and then iron mixed with clay. And so this idea of this image is what God is trying to reveal to Daniel, which he did in a vision at night, or, you know, as it says there earlier in chapter 2, but it was for the sake that the king would be able to know and understand what's happening. And so Daniel reveals this dream to the king that was revealed to Daniel, of course, as we had learned before. It was through the ministration of God the Father, through his son, through the angels, to the prophet, in this case, Daniel. And so we can know that Daniel was revealing this, and the king was just probably really interested in what was being described to him, because he remembered now, that's correct, this is the dream that God had given to me. And so Daniel was now standing up as one that was full of truth in the eyes of the king. And that's what God was trying to do as well. See, because God was trying to win the heart of Nebuchadnezzar, just as he had won the heart of Daniel already. So there's evangelism involved here too. When you learn what truth is and you share it, that's a very good application of what to do with the truth that you've learned. Share it with somebody who you know. And that's the benefit of learning what truth is so others too can be transformed and prepared for the coming of Jesus Christ in the clouds of heaven. So there's plenty of applications if you're looking for them. Take and find what is being said and apply it to yourself, and you'll be able to know and understand that the Bible in all its aspects is applicable to us, okay? So Jesus spoke in parables, and we can too. And so it says right here in verse 34, "Thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands." So now here's another thing that happens. First of all, there's all these materials, gold, silver, brass, iron, and then clay. And then there's a stone that comes up. "And the stone was cut out without hands." Now this phrase, without hands, if you were to copy this phrase and search it, you would actually find that what happens is you have this idea that something goes on four different times. It's only four times in the Bible that this phrase is used, right? Every single time this phrase is referred to as something that God does, I believe anyway, something that God does by himself. So a stone was cut out by God. All right, now there was a stone cut out of the mountain by God. Right here it says in verse Mark chapter 14:58, it says that I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another by God. God will do it, okay? Because we know that Christ is referring here to being in the grave, and we know that the Father, according to the Bible, is the one that raised Christ from the grave. And then it says here in verse 11, whom also you are circumcised with a circumcision made by God, in putting off the body of the sins of the flesh by the circumcision of Christ, right? So God the Father does it through his Son, and that's exactly what happens here as well. God raises his Son. He actually did it through an angel, and it was by God. And then, of course, the stone is cut out of the mountain by God, and we're reading about that in Daniel chapter 2, verse 34. So this without hands phrase is actually referring to what that which is done by God the Father. You saw till a stone was cut out by God the Father without hands, which smote the image upon the feet. Now remember, the feet were part of iron and part of clay. Now clay is something that is brittle, right? That's what we talk about later in the prophecy. So he smote the image on the feet that were of iron and clay. Now the iron didn't break, it probably just moved out of its place, but the clay was what shattered, causing the entire image to fall and be destroyed. And it break the image to pieces, right? So what we have is this image is in pieces. What size of pieces is this image in? It says there in verse 35, then the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, the gold, broke into pieces together, all of them. And they became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. Now, chaff is something that is like the husk of a grain, whether it be like, for example, if it's corn, you have the husk of the corn, right? If you have wheat, you only have the shell of the wheat. If you have something that's some different grain, whether it be amaranth or I can't remember all the grains right now, but they each have a husk, and that's what's being blown away. So very small pieces compared to the regular fruit or the regular harvest that you would be seeing. So this whole image that was made up of gold, silver, bronze, iron and clay was completely shattered and was like the chaff, okay? And notice what happens here in the Bible. It says that it became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away. Now, wind, of course, can refer to a lot of things in the Bible. In this, we're just going to refer to the fact that the wind carried them away. Carried what away? The chaff, those small pieces that were the leftover from the harvest. That no place was found for them, right? They were totally blown away. No place was found for them. Kind of like Satan was cast out of heaven and no place was found for him anymore there. That's in Revelation chapter 12. And the stone that smote the image, what happened to it? The stone became a great mountain and it filled the whole earth, right? So this stone that was cut out of the mountain, it became a great mountain and it filled the whole earth. So the whole earth was filled with the glory of this mountain. Of course, that stone refers to Christ, and we know that he is the stone of stumbling and the rock of offense. He is the rock of our salvation. And he is a rock that came from a greater rock, because as it says here, that the stone was cut out without hands. We learn later it was cut out of the mountain, right? So this is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. So the dream was said, and then the interpretation is coming right along with what is being said. I think it's important to understand here that when a dream comes in the Bible, or a vision or something like that, there is in the Bible most often, not every time, but most often, there is an interpretation for that vision, for that analogy, for that illustration, for that symbol. Some things don't have it. For example, like the word earth in the book of Revelation, it doesn't have a direct interpretation. Like the Bible doesn't say the earth is, except of course in the parables of Matthew 13, but that you don't have it right directly with it. And there are other things like Paul says to Timothy, for example, he gives a couple of illustrations about a soldier, and he doesn't really give an interpretation. He just says, you think about what this means and the Lord will reveal it to you. So sometimes you have to use your logic and the context and understand what the Bible is saying as a whole to be able to understand these things. But in this section, we're having a vision, and then the interpretation is given right away. And so we're going to learn a little bit more about that here. It says in verse 37, you, O king, are a king of kings. So for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. Now, wait a minute. That sounds like somebody else, because who else is the king of kings? If you look up this phrase, by the way, you're going to see that this phrase king of kings only occurs six times. You can see that right here in this little number. Six times the word King of Kings occurs, or the phrase. Artaxerxes is a king of kings. The king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, is a king of kings. We learned that Daniel just called Nebuchadnezzar the king of kings. We see that God the Father, the only potentate, is the king of kings. And we know also his son is king of kings, the Lord of Lords and King of Kings, as it says here in Revelation 17. And then we know that the son is referred to as the King of Kings again. And this is a name written on him. And I have an interesting thought in regard to this, but I won't deal with it now. But the idea of this in Daniel chapter 2, verse 37, Nebuchadnezzar being called a king of kings, well, he's a king that was given things by a greater king. So King Nebuchadnezzar was a king of kings, but that means he was, in this context anyways, he was given, as it says, the God of heaven has given you kingdom and power and strength and glory. Well, guess what? Jesus Christ, the King of Kings, also received kingdom and power, strength and glory. You can read that in Revelation chapter 5. And of course, that was given by the God of heaven, his Father. You can read that in Hebrews chapter 1. And so Nebuchadnezzar here, in just a small sense, is a reflection of Jesus Christ, right? So remember, we were talking about in Daniel chapter 1, the idea that Christ came from Jerusalem to a Babylonian area to be tested on diet, in regard to diet, and he was faithful. There was no idolatry in him. He was found 10 times better than everybody around him, and then he was able to sit at the right hand of the king. That was the story of Jesus, but also at the same time it's the story of Daniel, because they both went through a very similar experience. And so here in Daniel chapter 2, you can see that King Nebuchadnezzar is reflecting, in a sense, a small sense, that he is similar to Jesus Christ, the King of Kings, who had received all things from somebody above him, if you will, the Father. And so you have this illustration being given to us in the story of Daniel chapter 2. About Jesus. In verse 38, wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of heaven, has he, God of heaven, has he given into your hand, and he has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. So you, as a ruler over all things, you as a ruler, as a king, you are this head of gold. So the king represents this head of gold. The king obviously has a kingdom. And so we would easily suggest that thou art this head of gold means that Babylon is represented, and the leadership of Babylon is represented by the head of gold, right? So it says there in verse 39, after these shall arise another kingdom. So this is now another one, another kingdom. It doesn't say another king, like you, king, are this head of gold, but it doesn't say another kingdom is going to come, a king is going to come. It says another kingdom, which of course has a king. So when it's talking about you, king, are this head of gold, it refers to the kingdom. After you shall arise another kingdom with a king, but this kingdom is going to be inferior. Another third kingdom of brass, another inferior metal, will be given. It, just like the one before it, will bear rule over all the earth. Just like King Nebuchadnezzar ruled over all, so the third will rule over all. And that's just like the second one as well. We're actually dealing with world-ruling kingdoms here. We've seen Babylon, and then another inferior one's going to come, and then another third one's going to come that will also rule over all the earth. So it doesn't say that the second one rules over all the earth, but you can find in history and also in the Bible in chapter 8 that Babylon is followed by Medo-Persia, which is followed by Greece. These were all three world-ruling kingdoms. And then, of course, the fourth one is a world-ruling kingdom as well. We're going to find a little bit more here as we go on, though. And it says, so the third one will bear rule over all the earth. And it says the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron. So now it's also the fourth kingdom, which as the first one and the third one bore rule over all the earth. Okay, so we're looking at world ruling kingdoms, four of them right here, actually. And it will be strong as iron, just as much as iron breaks in pieces and subdues all things. And as iron that breaks these, shall it break in pieces and bruise. Now, I want to show you something that I think is very interesting. In Daniel chapter 7, this is another king, Belshazzar. It's not Nebuchadnezzar, but this is later in Babylonian history. He was Belshazzar, king of Babylon. Daniel this time dreamed a dream, and you can see that he dreams of four great beasts, kind of like four metals, right? But the first was like a lion, the second was like a bear, okay, another beast, a second one was like a bear. It says, then I beheld another, third one was a leopard, and then the fourth was dreadful and terrible. Now I'm going to switch back real quick to Daniel chapter 2, and we're going to see that this fourth kingdom, it was like iron, and notice what it did. It brake in pieces and subdued all things, and it had iron that breaks all these things. Shall it break in pieces and bruise? So it's iron and it breaks in pieces everything, right? Notice in chapter 7, the fourth beast, like the fourth metal, it was dreadful and terrible. It was strong exceedingly, kind of like the strong iron we read about in chapter 2. It had great iron. Notice it says iron. I had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces, just like in chapter 2. It stamped the residue with the feet of it, and it was different or diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. 10 horns? Wait a minute. This beast, it was strong, like in Daniel chapter 2, the fourth metal. It was iron teeth, like the Daniel chapter 2 image had iron legs. It break in pieces, just like the iron portion of the image of Daniel chapter 2. It's destroyed everything, and the feet is what's being referred to. And then it has 10 horns, kind of like the feet have 10 toes. And so we have a very close relation between what goes on in Daniel chapter 2 and what goes on in Daniel chapter 7, right? So Daniel chapter 2 is an image of four different metals. And then there's this image, or the last metal goes into 10 different sections. Well, guess what? Because of the toes, right? 10 different toes. And so over here in Daniel chapter 7, we have four different beasts. And the last one has 10 horns, kind of like the 10 toes. And so you have a lot of similarities. I'm not going to get into the details now, but there are a lot of similarities. If you look at the gold and the first beast, the silver and the second beast, the bronze and the third beast, and the iron and the fourth beast, which we did just now, you'll see a lot of parallels between chapter 2 and chapter 7. And the reason why is because what God is doing is he's going over the history of the nations in Daniel chapter 2. He goes over the history of the nations in Daniel chapter 7. And then there's another chapter in chapter 8 that does the same thing. Except it's kind of interesting because what we've seen in chapter 2 and also chapter 7, let me get that right, is that we've seen Babylon and then other nations. Well, in Daniel chapter 8, it doesn't start with Babylon. The reason why is because it comes in at a time where the Medes and the Persians are ruling. And so we have Daniel chapter, or the book of Daniel chapter 8, starting a little bit later in history compared to Babylon. It actually starts in Medo-Persia. I'll show you real quick what that means there in the book of Daniel chapter 8. You're going to see verse 20. Now, in Daniel chapter 8, there's a ram and there's a goat. Okay, if you read previously in this chapter, you'll see that there's a ram and there's a goat. That's what the story is. And so the interpretation in this same chapter of Daniel chapter 8, the ram which you saw having two horns is the kings of Media and Persia. So the ram represents the Medo-Persians, or Media and Persia. And so in Daniel chapter 8 verse 21, the goat, he is the king of Grecia. Okay, so in Daniel chapter 8, we start with the ram, which is Medo-Persia. Well, in Daniel chapter 2 and 7, we started with Babylon. Well, after Babylon was overtaken by Medo-Persia, then Babylon is no longer in the timeline of history. And so you start with Medo-Persia, and then you go on to Greece, right? So far, what we've seen in the Bible is that you are this head of gold, king of Babylon, and then after the king of Babylon comes the Medo-Persians, and then the Grecians. Well, what nation comes after Grecia? Well, okay, so we can see in history, but we can also see from the Bible and in the story of Christ, that we have the Babylonian kingdom, the Medo-Persian kingdom, the Grecian kingdom, and then another kingdom that bears rule over all the earth. Well, Medo-Persians, excuse me, Babylon rather, was actually ruling in the 600s. Medo-Persia came in later, and then Greece was ruling all the way till like the 168 is when they were actually overtaken by the next world ruling kingdom. And so what you have here is you have to ask the question, who is this? Who is this fourth kingdom that rules over all after Babylon, Medo-Persia, and Greece, according to the Bible? Well, we can actually see it. It's right here in the story of Luke chapter 2. It says, it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree, so this is a law here, from somebody, Caesar Augustus. Now, where did Caesar Augustus rule? All the Caesars ruled in Rome. Caesar Augustus ruled in Rome. And his decree was that all the world, all of it, all the world should be taxed. Now, how would it be that the Caesar Augustus would be able to decree or make a law that all the world should be taxed? Well, because Rome was ruled by the Caesars, right? And all the world was under the control of the Caesars who were in Rome. And so when Greece was destroyed in 168 by Rome, it continued leading the world for a long time, actually. And so during the time of Christ, Caesar was able to command that all the world should be taxed. And so according to the Bible, the great kingdoms of the world, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome, were the ones referred to in Daniel chapter 2 and also in Daniel chapter 7. You have the the four medals of Daniel chapter 2 and the four beasts of chapter 7. And it's Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. Those four kingdoms are being reflected by the medals and the beasts. And so in Daniel chapter 2, what you're seeing is actually a foretold history of the world. Now, what I mean is foretold history. It's prophecy that hadn't been fulfilled yet, or history that hadn't been fulfilled yet. Prophecy is something that's talked about before it even happens. And so God was revealing to the king and through Daniel what it was that was in regard to his kingdom, the next kingdom, the next kingdom, the next, and even on to the coming of Christ, which was the stone that was coming that would break all of the previous kingdoms to cause them to be like chaff, right? So we have this story in Daniel chapter 2, I think, as a beautiful explanation of what's going on with the four kingdoms. Remember, they're Babylon is the head of gold. There's another kingdom, which is Medo-Persia. There's a third kingdom, which was Greece. And the fourth kingdom, which was Rome, according to Luke chapter 2. And it's interesting how that this fourth kingdom actually breaks in pieces everything, as Rome did. And then that it's like potter's clay. And potter's clay is very brittle. Like, for example, if you took a pot that was made with potter's clay or clay from outside, you dried it up and it was a pot, but you broke it, it would shatter, right? That's kind of what's being described here. It's this, these feet are completely destroyed by not only the stone, but even before that, that it breaks into 10 divisions, like the 10 toes. And so Rome in history actually broke into 10 divisions, 476 AD. So in the year of our Lord, 476, you can see that the nations were separated. And it took time to separate, so they started separating before that. But during that time, the nations of Rome were separated into 10 divisions. It was the Huns, the Ostrogoths, the Visigoths, the Franks, the Vandals, the Suevi, the Burgundians, the Heruli, the Anglo-Saxons, and the Lombards. Those are specifically the kingdoms that were divided during the time of Rome back in the day. Now, this 10 toes scenario, or the 10 horns of Daniel chapter 7, goes very well along with history, showing us what God had proven to be true and accurate, not only beforehand, but also afterwards. You can look back and see, like, wow, God foretold all of what the world history would be, and he foretold it years before it happened, so that later in history, we'd be able to look back and say, wow, God knew beforehand. He knew the end from the beginning, so that we'd be able to know that all of the Bible prophecies are founded not only on the Bible, but also on history, showing that we can trust the Bible, we can trust God, we can understand what it is that God has revealed to us, and we can be able to be blessed in all the things that God reveals in his word. So what we have here is, according to the Bible, we have the toes are part of iron and part of clay. In that way, the kingdom would be partly strong and partly broken. Now, the word broken is actually fragile, okay? Not as strong. So you have this iron kingdom, and it's partly strong and partly broken. Now, I wonder, what does this clay refer to, okay? We have clay being referred to in several different scenarios in the Bible, but I'm going to look at this one, Isaiah 64, verse 8. This one refers to Isaiah 64, verse 8. But now, O Lord, you are the Father, okay? You are our Father. We are the clay, and you, Father, are our potter, okay? So the potter is the one that is manipulating the clay to make a pot or a jar or something that, you know, you hold something in, right? So we, as humans, are jars of clay, right? According to Corinthians, we are to be filled with the glory of the Lord, right? The oil that comes from the two olive trees, and they are pouring from themselves the golden oil into the vessels, like it says in Zechariah chapter 4. That's describing the ministry of the Spirit and how we are vessels filled, just like the seven branch candlestick was filled with the oil. We are to be the light of the world. We are the branches, or those that are containing that light and the flame of the Spirit of God in our lives, so that we'll be able to light those that are around us, right? So that's the idea. We are the church. We are the people of God. We are the clay. Except here, it's talking about, like in Isaiah 64, as it was saying, that we as Israel is the church. But notice, it's Rome that's connected with the clay. So Rome is connected with this clay church, right? I'm going to show you another section of the Bible where it's actually talking about this clay idea. Jeremiah 18, the word which came to Jeremiah, which was the word of the Lord, and he was saying, arise, go down to the potter's house. Now, we've already seen in Isaiah that the Bible teaches that God the Father is the potter, right? So go down to the potter's house, and there I will cause thee to hear my words. Then I went down to the potter's house and brought, and behold, he, the potter, wrought a work on the wheels. So he was working with his hands with the clay. And the vessel that he made of clay was marred in the hand of the potter. So he basically, he kind of squished it up, right? He marred it. He destroyed it instead of keeping it as this beautiful vessel that was being made. And so it goes on. It says the vessel that he made of clay was marred in the hand of the potter. So he made it again into another vessel, as seemed good to the potter or the father to make it, right? Then the word of the Lord came to me saying, O house of Israel, cannot I do with you as this potter, saith the Lord? Behold, as the clay is in the potter's hand, so are you in my hand, O house of Israel. And so what God is saying to the children of Israel through Jeremiah is that God can work with the clay as he wants to. Now, this is God working with clay. But in Daniel chapter 2, we actually have iron that's mixed with clay. And so it's not really God's church necessarily. It's a Roman church. So the church of that was in Rome, because Rome was ruling the whole world and then the clay came in, Rome came up with this church that actually was mixed together. So what we have in the Roman era, or the fourth metal, is actually a Roman church. Rome mixed together with clay, which is a church. So you have this Roman church, and today the only way we can describe that is in history we have a Roman church, which we know today as the Roman Catholic Church, that is the Roman Church of the world. And so we have this scenario that's actually pouring out a little bit more information, and you actually go further as you study chapter 7 and chapter 8. You realize that right there in Daniel chapter 2, it's describing that there's Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, and then a Roman church that comes together. And after that Roman church comes together with Rome, then you have this divisions that goes into the world, which is 10 divisions. And you can learn that from Roman history. It's amazing what the Bible describes and all these little details as you go through and understand what's going on. But let me share with you just a couple of more verses here in Daniel chapter 2, and then we'll take some more questions, or some questions, as was talked about earlier. It says in verse 44, in the days of these kings. Now, what does that mean, these kings? Well, it's talking about the feet, right? The feet that were partly iron and partly of clay, the toes that were being referred to, and just like in Daniel chapter 7, it's the horns that were on top of the head of that beast. Well, it's saying these kings. Well, you know, in Daniel chapter 7, it talks about, I'll just show it to you real quick. Daniel chapter 7, verse 23. The fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom, which shall be diverse. It might even actually be, let's see, there it is, verse 24. The 10 horns of this kingdom, what are they? They are 10 kings, right? So the horns are kings. So what we read before, if you recall, is that there's 10 toes in Daniel chapter 2, and then there's 10 horns in Daniel chapter 7, where it's Daniel chapter 2 that's saying that these toes are partly of iron, partly of clay, or the feet anyways. And then it says in the days of these kings. Well, Daniel chapter 7 has already told us that there's 10 horns, like there are 10 toes, and then later he says these horns are actually kings. So if you do a little bit of connecting the dots, you realize that the 10 toes in Daniel chapter 2 are actually being referred to as the 10 kings. So what it says is in the next verse there, in verse 44, in the days of these kings, not toes or not horns, but it's interpreting here, in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom. And we know that kingdom is going to be that big great stone that was cut out of a mountain, which shall never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall be left to, shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. For as thou sawest that the stone, which is the kingdom, was cut out of the mountain. So there's a stone that is cut out of the mountain, just like the Son of God was brought forth from the Father, or Eve was brought forth from Adam. The stone was cut out of the mountain without hands. That means it was done by God. And it break in pieces the iron, which is Rome, the brass, which is Greece, the clay, which is part of the iron and the feet there of Rome and the connection there, the silver, which is Medo-Persia, and the gold, which is Babylon. So it actually goes, in the most case, backwards. Instead of gold, silver, brass, iron, and then clay, it mostly goes backwards here. And so the great God has made known unto the king what shall come to pass hereafter, and the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof is sure. And so what we have seen, again, just covering this idea, is that in the midst of this time, where in the time of the hour of judgment, God revealed these things to Daniel, which was that he gave him the spirit of prophecy. In that spirit of prophecy, what we have is Daniel being revealed this idea of God giving a dream showing that the kingdoms of the world will come, Babylon being the first there, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. Rome is connected with a church, which is the clay, and then it's divided into 10. Now, after a time, in the days of these kings, is when God sets up his kingdom, which is the coming of the stone, which is Christ coming the second time and setting up his kingdom after the 1,000 years, of course, on the earth. And we know that the meek shall inherit the earth. So it's wonderful to know that God has revealed these amazing things to us in prophecy. And I'm glad to be able to have shared a little bit with you. And so if there are any questions, please feel free to take this time to ask them. And then after the questions, we will be able to have a moment of prayer. And then, of course, we'll be blessed with some of the comments that come afterwards as well. So, okay, good. So thank you for the questions. The first one came up asking about why does it start in Babylon instead of going to Assyria? In light of many prophecies, the prophecy actually begins during the time in which the prophet is living. That's why you can see, for example, in Daniel chapter 2 and 7, Daniel was living in the time of Babylon. Well, in chapter 8, he was living in the time of the Medes and Persians, because the Medes and Persians had already come and destroyed Babylon. And so it starts with the Medes and Persians. John, for example, in the book of Revelation, he was writing prophecies that started in the time of Rome. And so we can understand that you have a lot of prophecies that are starting with the time when the prophet is living. And so Daniel didn't write about previous nations or kingdoms because God wanted him at that time to start where he was to be able to go forward from that point in time. I hope that's helpful, and it's pretty consistent with the Bible. The 144,000, is it literal or symbolic? You know, lots of people have different ideas. I have given a presentation on that. I've sent a link, and feel free to go through that link if there are questions about what I presented in that message. Feel free to ask at a different time. Now, the clay, I felt like we went over the clay a little bit already. The clay is dealing specifically with a religious group of people, those that are claiming to be molded or melded by God and shaped and formed into his image and character. But that is not always the case when, of course, the like in Daniel chapter 2, where Rome was connected with this clay. It was not God's people that were combined with Rome. It was the another church scenario, another those that claim to be led by God that were referred to. So clay in and of itself is referring to a religious group of people, those that are claiming to be children of God. And so verses from Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome, I felt like we did that already, looking at Daniel chapter 2, you are this head of gold, chapter 8 refers to Medo-Persia and Greece, and then Luke chapter 2 deals with Rome. And you don't find other world ruling kingdoms in the Bible that's between those times, Babylon and our day here. Except, of course, when it's referring in prophecies of Revelation, but dealing with the book of Daniel, that's what's being dealt with. If there are other verses, feel free to share them. And then the practical applications. Well, I did address that at the beginning because I know that a lot of people do ask that question, like what's practical about the three angels' messages in Daniel? We talk about idolatry. That is a very practical thing. Idolaters will not be in heaven. The Bible says that in Revelation 22. You can read it for yourself. So idolatry, turning from idolatry, knowing who God is from the Bible and serving him and him alone, of course, through his son, we can find that that is not idolatry. That is what the Bible is calling us to do in regard to worship. How do you worship? Well, of course, you in whatsoever you eat, whatsoever you drink, whatsoever you do. So there's eating, there's drinking, and doing. All of that, do all to the glory of God. Now, we could talk about eating for lots of messages. We could talk about what you drink, whether it be alcohol or not, for lots of messages. And same thing with whatsoever you do. So these are principles that we can apply. Now, Leviticus 11, Deuteronomy 14, they talk about some of the foods that you should not and you can eat. So foods that you could and what you shouldn't. But Daniel chapter 1 actually gives us pulse, which refers to the beans, nuts, grains, fruits, and vegetables. That's what pulse is. That's what Daniel asked for. And this is an end time book. You can find that in chapter 12 of the book of Daniel. And you can see that in verses 4 and 9, that it's illustrating that at the end of time, at the time of the end, is when this book is going to be especially applicable. Well, the diet of pulse, things that are sown, things that are grown, things that we are to be partaking of from the earth, that is the best diet. Now, we can go on to talking about a lot of things in regard to diet, but that is what Daniel chapter 1 illustrates as an example for living at the end of time. Eating beans, nuts, grains, fruits, and vegetables, and drinking water. Those things are wonderful. So the diet is extremely important. Is it relevant to your salvation? Of course it is, because the Bible says whatsoever you eat, do it all to the glory of God. What if you eat something that's not to the glory of God? Is that salvational? Well, sure, like what if I drank gasoline? Would that be like something that was intelligent? Would that be killing myself? Yes. Would that be something that would affect my salvation? Well, probably I'd be killing myself, right? Well, what if I drink alcohol? That's killing yourself. That's actually breaking the commandments. And the Bible teaches, and the reason why it's breaking the commandments is because it says, thou shalt not kill. That means yourself too. If I'm smoking, I'm killing myself. If I'm eating something that is causing me to die slowly, yes, it's killing me. It's breaking the commandments. And so yes, diet is a moral issue. It's not amoral. It is a moral issue. And so we can see and understand that the people at the time of the end in Revelation chapter 12, for example, verse 17, they will be keeping the commandments of God. Chapter 14, verse 12 in the book of Revelation, they will be keeping the commandments of God. chapter 22, verse 14, they will be blessed and keeping the commandments of God. That's in the book of Revelation. And so you have this idea that in the end of time, there are going to be people that keep the commandments of God, including thou shalt not kill, which is referring to what you put into your body if you take it to that point, which I do. So I understand that diet is definitely salvational. That's why it's the first chapter as the keynote of the book of Daniel. Daniel is for the time of the end, and he was clear-minded. And that's what diet does. It clears up your mind. Like, for example, if you were to drink gasoline and you were to be eating just a big tub of lard, that's not going to be good for your brain. Your brain is going to be completely shut down. You're not going to be able to think. You're going to sleep. You're going to get sick and all this other stuff. And so if we're eating that which is healthy, we're going to be able to think clearly and sharply. That's what God is looking for, is a sharp mind. And so that's what the diet is in regard to salvation. It's in regard to your mind.